Happy Monday. Mackenzie Lambert here, your host for Mac and the Movies. Today we have a fun one. It is a Without the Riffs episode. We are going to take a look at five movies that were prominently featured on my all-time favorite TV show, Mystery Science Theater 3000. This is MST3K proper, not the revival, which I am not a big fan of for various reasons. I'll be covering today's films in chronological order of their release. We'll start with 1963's The Atomic Brain, then proceed through 1966's Manos, the Hands of Fate, 1975's Mitchell, 1983's Pod People, and close with 1990's The Final Sacrifice. At the end, I'll share my top 10 episodes of Mystery Science Theater 3000. Let's get into the movies. Oh, and spoilers abound. The Atomic Brain introduces us to Mrs. March, a wealthy old woman afraid of death. Desperate to prolong her lifespan, she employs scientist Dr. Frank to help give her extra life. The doctor has the ability to transplant brains from one body to another, even across species. He already implanted the brain of a dog into a man, now that beast roams the forest surrounding the house. One of the problems Dr. Frank frequently deals with is the nerve deterioration of the brain. If the rot is too much, the subject when revived is a mindless zombie. He needs live specimens for the transplant to have a better rate of success. To help with that, Mrs. March hires three women through an employment agency. There's Beatrice from England, Nina from Vienna, and Anita from Mexico. Mrs. March hopes to use one of their bodies for her brain. It doesn't take long for the girls to realize something is amiss, but when they reach the house, it is too late for them to escape. The Atomic Brain was not the original title for the film. When released theatrically, it was known as Monstrosity. The Atomic Brain title was introduced during its television run. The pacing of the film is its biggest flaw. For a movie only an hour and 4 minutes, it feels way longer than that. Not helping are the scenes of the characters talking with very little action or horror shenanigans to keep the viewer invested. However, it's not difficult to think how taboo this film was at the time. You have some partial nudity, the missing eye appliance on Beatrice is effective, there is some intrigue, but these moments are few and far between. Not surprisingly, this film probably benefited the most from the riffing of Mike and the Bots. The plotting pace is overtaken by the wit of Mike Nelson, Kevin Murphy, and Trace Beaulieu. It has one of my favorite riffs. When Mrs. March stands up from her wheelchair, Crow yells, "Mein Führer, I can walk!" The quickest way to my heart is a Dr. Strange love reference. Joseph V. Maselli made only one movie. The Atomic Brain was it. He's better known for being a cinematographer for exploitation legend Ray Dennis Steckler. Wild Guitar with Arch Hall Jr., known as being the quote-unquote teen idol in EGA with Richard Kiel as a California caveman, The Thrill Killers, and possibly the longest movie title ever, The Incredibly Strange Creatures Who Stopped Living and Became Mixed-Up Zombies. Although many sites claim that Jack Polexfen was an uncredited director. On The Atomic Brain, Polexfen was also the producer and co-writer of the script. He directed two other films, notably The Indestructible Man with a past-his-prime Lon Chaney Jr. as a mute, unstoppable killer out for revenge. Polexfen has a decent 22 credits as a writer. The music by Gene Kaur is a curiosity. It's a schizophrenic score, a wide range of styles. You have the ominous music, perfect for a horror film of its time. Then at times you have the sitcom lighthearted music. And then there's the famous old lady theme for Mrs. March. It's all over the place. Marjorie Eaton plays the fiendish Mrs. March. Despite being in this B picture, she managed to make her way into a couple of pop culture staples. She was Miss Persimmon in Mary Poppins. She was in an episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents and had a bit part in Bullet with Steve McQueen. Frank Gerstel is Dr. Frank. He was a TV regular, appearing in programs like The Red Skeleton Hour, I Love Lucy, Dragnet, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and Sunset Strip. Frank Fowler plays Victor, the assistant to Mrs. March. Fowler had a few small roles prior to The Atomic Brain, but after this film, he wouldn't act in another role until 1988 for the TV show Eagle's Crest, followed by an appearance on the revival of Dragnet in 1990 and the early 90s sitcom Blossom. Erica Peters, who plays Nina, had a few noted roles in her filmography. She was in the William Castle classic, Mr. Sardonicus. She also appeared with Elvis Presley in G.I. Blues. Judy Bamber plays Beatrice. She was in Roger Corman's A Bucket of Blood as Alice. Now I need to go back to revisit that film to see if I can find her. Here's all you need to know about Lisa Lang. She was credited as small role in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and minor role in Stars and Stripes Forever. Bradford Dillman provided the film's narration, and he was everywhere, TV and film. Man from U.N.C.L.E., Mission Impossible, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, Murder, She Wrote, and a few of the later Dirty Harry films with Clint Eastwood. Sadly, there are no credits for the actor who played Hans the Dog Man. This film is honestly a tough watch, even with the short runtime. You need the crew from The Satellite of Love to make it through this one. The Hands of Fate opens with a family going on a vacation. There's Michael, the father, Margaret, the wife, and Debbie, the daughter. They're on their way to a valley lodge, yet get lost along the way. They end up at a house with the satyr like Torgo watching the place while his master is away. With it getting dark, they decide to spend the night at the house, despite the warnings of Torgo. In the night, Torgo's master awakens, as does the master's wives. They hunt the family down so as to make Margaret the master's new wife. Torgo betrays the master in the hopes of making Margaret his wife, but is punished for his treachery. It's up to our hapless hero, Michael, to save his family. This is just a weird movie. Someone first had to put this idea to paper, then pitched to people to raise money, then they made the movie and released it for people to see it. I have to give credit to Warren for his drive to make the film. It's not easy making the film, no matter what anyone says. This is not the first movie to blow up after being featured on Mystery Science Theater 3000. That honor goes to Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. But this one has maintained a steady pop culture presence. It's maintained enough power for three sequels. In 2010, there was Manos, Search for the Valley Lodge. Tom Naiman, Jackie Naiman Jones, and Diane Marie returned to prize their respective roles as the Master, Debbie, and Margaret. The project was scrapped in 2014, shortly after the Naimans left due to creative differences. In 2013, there was Manos, The Rise of Torgo. As of November 2016, this was said to be in post-production, but no word since has dropped on this sequel. May 2018 had the release of Manos Returns. There was a delay in release due to the death of Tom Naiman as the master. It was released, but a copy has proven to be difficult to find. There are a few differences between the unedited version and the MST3K version. The opening features more driving and the family getting lost. One of the biggest surprises for me was the violent sequence of the master beating one of his wives. She is savagely slapped with her face covered in fake blood. For a cheesy movie that this is proclaimed to be, this scene stands out. Harold P. Warren is the man behind this infamous production. The whole thing started with a bet on the set of the TV show Route 66, where Warren had a walk-on role. Warren met with screenwriter Sterling Siliphant. Siliphant was a big deal. His TV credits include Perry Mason and Alfred Hitchcock Presents. His film credits include Village of the Damned, the Dirty Harry film The Enforcer, and the arm wrestling classic Over the Top with Sylvester Stallone. While at Coffee, Warren made the claim that it was easy to make a horror film, to which Siliphant took Warren on that bet. Warren was able to gather $19,000 for financing. Casting was filled with friends and members of the local theater community. The camera used by Warren was a 16mm Bell and Howell. This camera had a number of disadvantages. It had to be hand-cranked, it couldn't record sound, which meant that all the dialogue and sound effects were added in post-production. One could only record 30 seconds of footage before having to reload. The film premiered on November 16, 1966, in El Paso, Texas. After a few drive-in screenings, the film fell into obscurity and ended up in the public domain. It ended up in a collection of public domain films available from film suppliers. Through one of these suppliers, the film wound up in the hands of Frank Caniff. Caniff watched the film and suggested it to the rest of the crew on Mystery Science Theater 3000. The rest is history. Russ Huddleston and Robert Smith Jr. were responsible for the music of the film. Much like The Atomic Brain, the music is a range of styles. At the Segway, there was the weird, samba or bossa nova opening theme. There's the ominous music on the piano. Who could forget the haunting Torgo theme? Harold P. Warren was the star, director, writer, and producer of the film. He epitomizes indie, low-budget filmmaking, for better or worse. He was proud of the fact that he created one of the worst movies ever made. Sadly, Warren passed away in 1985. Tom Naiman plays the master and one of the few carryovers over the sequel attempts. No other roles. John Reynolds played Torgo. During the shoot, Reynolds was experimenting with LSD, hence why Torgo was uncoordinated and took so long to fondle co-star Diana Marie. Reynolds committed suicide a month before the film's premiere. Diane Adelson worked under the name Diane Marie. She was signed up for a West Texas beauty pageant to publicize the film. She managed to make it as a finalist in the pageant, but lost out. In one of the more amusing production anecdotes, before filming the peeping Torgo scene, Warren suggested that Adelson remove her top. Adelson vehemently refused, to which Warren assured her he was just testing her moral character. Jackie Naiman Jones had an acting career in indie horror aside from the Manos sequels. Manos is an insane movie that holds your attention, particularly if you're seeing it for the first time. Odd music choices, hammy performances, and it's very easy to find. a trade union lawyer, Walter Deeney, murdering a burglar. The police are called to investigate, with Deeney claiming he killed in self-defense. Mitchell suspects that isn't the case and wants to nail Deeney for murder. To get Mitchell off of Deeney, the police chief puts him on James Arthur Cummins. Cummins is linked to drug trafficking and stolen merchandise. Mitchell is to stay on Cummins until either he cracks or incriminates himself. Despite the reassignment, Mitchell is still eyeing Deeney. Deeney sends Greta, a prostitute, to distract Mitchell. The deeper Mitchell gets into both Cummins and Deeney's affairs, the more negative attention he receives. Soon, other criminal associates have their sights on Mitchell. Mitchell is a tough film to get through, much like The Atomic Brain, but this comes from the fact that there are no likable characters to root for, particularly the character of Mitchell. He's not charming, he's a slouch, or maybe this is just a reflection of the effort Joe Don Baker put into the role. Everyone seems to be on autopilot while acting in this movie. I think the significance of this film is boosted merely for the fact that this film was on the final episode for Joel Hodgson as the marooned human in space. I find it hard to believe that this movie was actually intended for a theatrical release. Apparently, I'm not the only one who is dispelled by this. Vincent Cambi of the New York Times said the film resembles something made for television than for a cinematic screen, with the basic cinematography of Harry Stradling Jr. and the editing of Fred Chillak. Yet, distributor Allied Artists thought this movie was perfect for the theater-going audience. The theatrical version is very different from the TV edit used for MST3K. There are more risque shots of Linda Evans post-coitus. The gunshots are more graphic, notably the wounds received by Morgan Paul and Martin Balsam. The dune buggy chase between Mitchell and Deeney shows why Saxon suddenly disappears from the film. If you see the original film, you'll be filled in on the blanks left by the misty edit. Director Andrew V. McLaglen had a number of westerns in his filmography. With the westerns dying out, he had to adapt to the films available. In the 1970s, it was the gritty cop films like Dirty Harry and The French Connection. Mitchell tried to be such a picture, and McLaglen did his best with the material. Ian Kennedy Martin wrote the script. Ian is the younger brother of Troy Kennedy Martin, who wrote the script for The Italian Job. Larry Brown and Jerry Steiner wrote the music for Mitchell. They did the Wachigawa guitar theme you heard of the segue. They also wrote the classic track, My Mitchell, performed by Hoyt Axton.
My Mitchell, what would your mama say if she ever knew that you were proud of carrying on that way, cracking in heads and jumping in and out of beds and hanging around the criminal scene? You are some kind of a star like the guys on the movie screen.
Joe Don Baker gives an uninvested performance in the title role. This was only 2 years after his iconic performance as Buford Pusser in Walking Tall. He comes off as tired, uninvigorated. It reeks of a paycheck movie. Look at almost any scene he's in, whether it's across from Saxon or Balsam or his superiors at the police station. He doesn't emote. Actually, I take that back. During one of the sex scenes with Evans, he's smiling, which kind of made me sick. Martin Balsam plays James Arthur Cummins. Given this was the mid-70s, I'm sure he was quick to get this film out of the way so he could go back to making films in Italy, like Confessions of a Police Captain, as well as Blood and Diamonds. Yet, this is also the period where he made Little Big Man, Taken of Pelham 1-2-3, and All the President's Men. John Saxon is having a devilish good time as Walter Deeney. He's clearly hamming it up as the bad guy that Mitchell wants to take down himself. People either know Saxon from his work on Enter the Dragon or for the Nightmare on Elm Street series. There's no shortage of great films starring this man. Linda Evans plays Greta. This was before she became a household name with the TV series Dynasty. Merlin Olsen plays Benton, the henchman for Cummins. Olsen, interestingly enough, appeared on an episode of the TV series based off of Walking Tall. He was also the star of the show Father Murphy, which puts Crow's riff completely into context.
I dreamed I was Father Murphy.
Mitchell is an unenjoyable experience because that sense of misery is on everyone's face as they plod along in the movie. Well, except for John Saxon. He's having a fun time playing a bad guy in Dini. This is one that needs the riffs of Joel and the Bots. People opens with a trio of poachers driving into the forest, looking to make their fortune stealing eggs and hunting game. One sees a meteor crash while the other two ignore him. The one hunter drives off to investigate, leaving the others behind. The one hunter enters a cave and sees bizarre eggs everywhere. He begins to smash them but is killed off by an off-screen monster. The other poachers assume he ran off. Meanwhile, in another subplot, we have a group of friends going into the forest. These kids are members of a pop band. The lead singer brings along a girl that was not welcomed by the other band members. The girl, being related to the label manager, makes the situation more complicated. During a spat with another girl, she runs off into the woods, only to be attacked by a creature and knocked off a cliff. Injured, the other teens try to find someone to call an ambulance. On our third subplot, a little boy is being looked after by his aunt and uncle. He has a knack for studying animals and insects. He stumbles across the den of the mysterious creature that killed the one poacher. He finds one egg intact and sneaks it back to his family's cabin. The egg hatches and the boy raises the creature. Here all the subplots meet. The remaining poachers are attacked by the alien. The teens find their way to the cabin of the kid and his family. Soon they're attacked by the creature, and the other creature raised by the little boy quickly grows to the size of the aggressive creature. Now the boy must protect his alien friend while trying not to bring harm to his family and the teens. Pod People was one mess of a film, keeping track of all the different subplots. Tonally, it's a schizophrenic offering. One moment it's a horror show, then it switches gears and becomes a Spielberg Boy and His Alien film. Director Juan Piquer Simón was dissatisfied with the film, and he has every right to be. If the film stuck with one genre, be it horror or family-friendly, it wouldn't have stood out as much. These changes of tone add to the fascination with this particular movie. Pod People is known by another title, ETV, Extraterrestrial Visitors. This Spanish-French co-production was clearly meant to capitalize on the monster success of Spielberg's E.T. the Extraterrestrial. This was typical of the European film markets, be it Spain, France, or Italy. Take a big hit from the American film market and essentially copy a film to gain a little runoff. The movie was originally meant to be a straightforward horror movie of an alien killing people, in the same vein as Galaxy Invader. Interesting note, clips of Galaxy Invader were used as the opening credits for some reason in the home video and MST3K version. This makes sense considering Simone was a horror director, but because of E.T., producers demanded changes to the script to make it closer to Spielberg's film. Simone was a noted director of horror films that earned their way to cult status. He gave us the Chainsaw Giallo pieces, there's also the late 80s gem Slugs. Pod People must have been a tough transition, as well as the bitterness of not making the movie he originally intended. Librado Pastor worked on the music of the original Spanish version. I'm honestly not sure if Pastor worked on the synth music, because there's another name credited as performing the music, Michael Demmer. Pastor worked on other Simone films, including pieces. Demmer would never work on another film after this one. I have no idea who's responsible for Hear the Engines Roll because there are no credits for the song, but I salute them. Can you bike red leather jacket on? River up tonight, let the engine go. Get them down the highway at the speed of light. All I want to feel is the wind in my eyes. With lots of money in my pocket and all the systems ready to go. With a pick of my wrist kicker to Kia. Stay as she goes, not long overdrive.
My eyes, with stacks of money in my pocket, and all systems ready.
actors of note worked on this film. Ian Sara played the band leader Rick, and he also appeared in Pieces. He had a short acting career before becoming a producer. There's also Frank Branagh. He got his start in a bunch of spaghetti westerns, a few unofficial Django films, the first two entries of the Cat and Hutch trilogy, that would be God Forgives, I Don't, and Ace High. He had small roles in the Leone trilogy with Clint Eastwood. He was in the Three Fantastic Supermen Go West, as well as the second installment of the Blind Dead series. Pod People is a mind-boggling trip. It goes tonal and genre extremes. There's a few familiar faces from Simone's other films. The music is a hoot. This one holds up compared to some of the other films. Sacrifice introduces us to Troy, who is studying the archaeological findings of his father, who died 7 years ago. Troy's curiosity gets the attention of an evil cult led by the sinister Satoris. Both parties are in search of a hidden city. Without the help of Zap Rousedower, the cult would have killed Troy and the information of the lost city would have fallen into Satoris' hands. Troy and Zap meet Mike Pipper. Pipper was a colleague of Troy's father. Pipper helps provide the missing pieces of information that Troy's father didn't uncover. Soon, Troy and Zap confront Satoris in the final battle to save humanity from the influence of the cult. Director Jardas Gradenus was a student of the Southern Alberta Institute of Technology enrolled in the filmmaking program. Actor Christopher Malcolm was one of Jardas' classmates. The two collaborated, along with Bruce J. Mitchell, on the screenplay, albeit uncredited. With a budget of $1,500 and rented equipment, they made the final sacrifice. With that budget, they made the best movie possible. This is the case with the likes of Ed Wood, Harold P. Warren, and Tommy Wiseau. Because they tried to aspire to higher standards and failed to do so, that doesn't take away from the sincerity that was put into this film. Because of that, I can find some basic degree of enjoyment out of the likes of The Final Sacrifice and Manos, the Hands of Fate. With the budget this film had, it's amazing it reached any audience. Credit to Jardas and crew for even getting this film made. Were it not for MST3K, it would have disappeared. No VHS or Laserdisc copies remain in print, but I was able to find the full movie on YouTube. Jardas Gradenus made The Final Sacrifice and managed to make a long career for himself, directing behind-the-scenes featurettes for the films of Michael Mann. The theatrical version of Miami Vice, Collateral, The Last of Mohicans, Ali, and Public Enemies. I believe if you look on the DVDs for these movies, you'll find the featurettes directed by Gradenus. Actor Christian Malcolm, who played Troy, had a few credits on film, staying mostly with stage productions. He had a bit part on the TV miniseries Band of Brothers, as well as the action thriller Hannah with Cate Blanchett and Eric Bana. Other than an appearance on Ray Bradbury Theater, Bruce J. Mitchell never appeared in another movie after The Final Sacrifice. It's fair to say he didn't need to. He became a cult figure after just one movie. Good for him. Shane Marceau was the evil Satoris. Marceau's only other appearance on film was 1992's Killer Image. He played a generic punk, but the film featured noted character actors Michael Ironside and M. Emmett Walsh. Ron Anderson steals the film as Mike Pipper. His Yosemite Sam delivery is such an over-the-top treat. He comes off as something out of the Red Green Show.
What the hell are you doing here? Wall. That cursed cult leader send you here to spy on me?
You know him?
Get him up! Get him up! I'm splatting your brains all over this place.
No, it's Matter of fact, we just escaped from him.
What's that there mark doing on your shoulder there?
It's a long story. McGregor, tell him my love.
McGregor? Troy McGregor? Thomas' son?
Yeah. Did you know him?
Pepper had a few... Anderson had a few other credits, but nothing of significance. The duo of Rousdower and Troy are amusing enough, but when Pipper enters the film, he takes it to a whole new level. I enjoyed The Final Sacrifice without the riffs from Mike and the Bots. I could hear them in my head, yet I was still able to enjoy what the film was still offering me all its own. You can find this film on YouTube, and it's well worth the time you'll spend seeing it. And that finishes this episode of Mac and the Movies. There are still plenty of films that were featured on Mystery Science Theater 3000 that I can find without the riffs. And I'll review those for another edition later on down the line. Okay, now for my top 10 MST3K episodes. Number 10, Pod People. For all the reasons that I listed above, I even put out a tweet for feedback about movie suggestions for this episode. Pod People was a favorite among a number of people who responded. Number 9, Cave Dwellers, a Conan knockoff from Joe D'Amato starring Miles O'Keefe. Such a goofy movie that manages to keep a straight face. Number 8, Puma Man, for this reason alone.
Puma Man, he flies like a moron. He has the power to rear project major cities.
Number 7, Merlin's Shop of Mystical Wonders. An insane episode featuring a film, an anthology film, with just some of the weirdest stories you can think of. And also, you've got Ernest Borgnine. Number 6, Soul Taker. Joe Estevez and Robert Zadar. Enough said. Number 5, Warrior of the Lost World. You've got Fred the Hammer Williamson. You've got Greta and Donald Pleasance. What more do you need? Okay, how about a smart mouth motorcycle and the paper chase guy? Number 4, Space Mutiny.
Tell me, Dave.
Slab Bulkhead.
Fridge Large Meat.
Punt Speed Chunk.
Butch Deadlift. Bold Big Flank.
Splint Chest Hair.
Flint Iron Stag.
Bolt Vanderhuge.
Thick McRunfast.
We put our faith in Blast Hard Cheese.
Buff Drink Lots.
Oh, slab. Oh, hunk. Oh, flink.
Let's get out there! Kick the back!
Trunk slam chest!
Fist rock bone!
Stump beef knob!
Smash slam jaw!
Punch rock groin!
Buck plank chest!
Stump junkman!
Dirk hard peck!
Rip steak face!
Slate slab rock!
Crud bone meal!
Rip slag cheek!
Punch side iron!
Gristle McThorn body!
Slake fist crunch.
Buff hardback.
Bob Johnson.
Number 3, Mitchell. Number 2, The Atomic Brain. And number 1, The Final Sacrifice. Okay, next time I'm making the movies, I'll be doing another primer like I did for Goblin back on Halloween of last year. This time I'll be taking a look at the life, career, and lasting pop culture presence of legendary guitarist Django Reinhardt. That will drop on Monday, June 24th. Until then, this is Mackenzie Lambert for Mac and the Movies. Take care, folks.
Last night.
No.
My mother doesn't like you.
Well, I don't like your mother.
Why not?
Why not?
No, why not?
No, why not?
Why are you repeating what I say?
Why are you repeating what I say?
I'm not.
Well, I'm not.
You are.
Cuss off.
What?
What?
What did he say?
What'd you say?
Did you say something?
You say something?
You said piss off.
You're lying through your teeth.
You're lying through your teeth.
Piss off, huh?
Piss off.
Piss off, kid!